This morning I will try and say something about cultural and creative industries. This afternoon we will have a presentation by three people, on creative clusters in China and approaches to planning cultural parts of the city. Tomorrow I will say something in the morning about creative cities, and then we will have two lectures in the following days from Scott McQuire from the University of Melbourne, and he will be talking about the digital city, questions around the digital nature of the city. So very contemporary questions that are beginning to be asked in across the globe, really. So This morning I will talk, trying to say something about the cultural and creative industries. And it, maybe in the question session, I will speak for maybe an hour, but in the questions, maybe we can ask something about the Chinese situation with this, because we can talk about it more in dialogue form. But just to say that in 2005, both the Shanghai government adopted the term creative industries and really promoted the idea, I think, within China. Hong Kong had also, Shanghai had also adopted this slightly earlier. And I think the Beijing government was thinking a lot about these ideas. So it's a big question, the idea of creative industries. And I want to hear today maybe ask some real questions about it from that point of view. So I'll give you some background. So it's often presented that the creative industries somehow introduces the economic dimension to culture. People say creative industries, right? It's about culture, but it's about economics. It's about producing wealth. And I say my first statement: this is not true. The question of the economics of culture has been with us for a very long time, and I would say in the West it's been with us since Gutenberg. And of course, as you know, Gutenberg invented, we know it, Chinese had invented it before him, but for us Europeans, Gutenberg invented the printing press, the printed book. And from that moment, the idea of culture and economics has been said. So it's a long question, and I just wanted to make that statement. And I want to give a historical perspective to this question. When we say, however, when we say the culture industry, we usually mean, or we usually talk about the work of Adorno, Theodore Adorno, and also his colleague Max Horkheimer, and they were from the Frankfurt School, and I think they're quite famous in this regard, and they were Germans who left Germany because of the rise of fascism, the Nazi party, and they went to America. And they were Marxists, and they were quite shocked by what they found in America. And they thought that that in some ways, maybe the American culture industry was a very successful propaganda for the American system. And they wrote a book in 1949, or they wrote a chapter in a book in 1949 called The Culture Industry. Now, maybe you are familiar with this idea, but the first thing to say is the culture industry is not about commercial culture, or rather, it's not only about commercial culture that's bought and sold. because commercial culture, as I said, has been with us for many hundreds of years. Shakespeare was commercial culture. I mean, people paid money. The great novelists, Balzac or Victor Hugo or Charles Dickens, made money from selling books. Now, Adorno had some problems with commercial culture, but commercial culture has been with us for a long time. What Adorno is talking about is industrial culture, which means highly organized, mass-produced culture. And he's talking about the American television, the Hollywood films, the American music industry based in New York. And he was saying that this is not just commercial culture. This is highly organized industrial culture, like a factory. You know, there's the writer, director, producer, actors, cinema, recording, distribution, like a huge factory. And Adorno's problem was that this culture was pre-programmed. It meant, that is, the audience response was already known. All it did was to give the audience what they want. They produced things knowing what this automatic response would be. And there was no room for any critical thought. It was ideological control, but it was basically to relax the workers so that they work all day and then they watch television at night, go to sleep, get up, go to the factory. So it was this idea. It had the culture. All it was just simple relaxation, uncritical relaxation for the workers. The actual theory of the cultural industry is much more complicated than that. I've simplified it because this is how it was mostly understood, the culture industry. Now, in the 1960s, this idea was challenged. And it was challenged not by people in favour of mass culture. It was actually challenged by many Marxist political economists. And it's interesting that it's they who actually begin to really criticise Adorno. Because what they say is something very simple and quite obvious, which is culture in capitalism is not just, it's not some propaganda produced by the state. You know, there isn't a ministry of film that produces film for the workers. It's actually a business, a big business. So what they began to say is that culture is a commodity and it's subject to the laws of commodity. So basically, you've got to sell it. If you don't sell it, then you will go out of business. Okay, right. So it's more than just ideology. It also needs to make money. Now, using Marxist terminology, you could say it needs to provide a use value based on the consumer's own desires, on what they want to consume. So you can't just endlessly repeat the same old thing, endlessly repeat the same formula. You must somehow appeal to this use value, to the needs or the desires of consumers. So I think this is an important statement. It sounds obvious, but it's clear then that the culture industry cannot just be pure ideology. And of course, the second aspect that they point is that there isn't just one thing called the culture industry, as if there's a big skyscraper with people making culture for the masses. In fact, it's a very fragmented system. And there are very different principles, business principles, in the different areas. So, for example, if you're in pop music, you sell records before DVDs or before CDs. You sell records, physical things that go into shops and somebody pays money and takes this physical thing back. That's their business model. But if you're in film, you make money, this is in the 1960s, in film you make money by people coming in to the cinema. You charge money at the door. Newspapers, well, you pay a little bit for the piece of paper, but also they get money from advertisement. Television, before credit cards and satellite, television was free. Anybody could watch it. And television had to make money by selling advertisements. These are very different business models. And of course, within these different businesses, there were many different companies, competing companies. So what we've got is not the culture industry, but the cultural industries, plural. And I think that's also important. And these cultural industries need to make money. And the third big question was the idea of creative input. So who's making this stuff? Who's making this culture? Because for Adorno, he says almost that soon the artists, the creators, are going to be like factory workers. You know, they'll just be there making the culture, making the films or making the records, just like a factory. But in fact, by the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, there were, you know, the creatives, the artists, weren't employed on salaries. They were independent, freelance. They still remained small-scale cultural producers. They weren't part of the big factory. And actually, as we'll see in a minute, how you manage the creative input is very, very difficult. It's not a question of saying, right, we've got to get 50 filmmakers and we'll employ them for 1 year and we'll put them in a factory and try start making films. Doesn't work like that. So what happened in the 1960s and 70s was that this idea of the culture industry became more complicated. But another key aspect was that for anybody alive in the 1960s and 1970s, it was clear that one of the most energetic, exciting, innovative, radical, challenging areas of culture was commercial culture. If you think about pop music, the Beatles or the Who or the Rolling Stones or the American independent filmmakers who were beginning to come in the 60s and 70s, or the publishing industry producing new kinds of books, popular culture. You know, popular culture became very, very radical, but it was commercial culture to some extent. So it was clear that Adorno's model was not really correct. So what are these new industries? Well, first, simple, it's the cultural value that's the basis of economic value. I spoke earlier about use value, and I think that's a very complicated question. But basically, unless they have use to you, unless you feel you want them, you like them, you enjoy them, you're not going to buy them. So if I make a CD, this CD costs maybe one quai to make one CD. And I can sell it to you for a lot of money if you want it, but if you don't want it, it's worth nothing. So again, it's obvious, but the cultural value is the basis of an economic value. And this makes it quite a difficult kind of industry. And one of the key things in the cultural industries is that production is organised around the future unknown value of a product. Because if I sell you something today, great, everybody buys it. But tomorrow, you might not want it because, well, it's old-fashioned, we've seen it, we've moved on to something else. So we make things for, we think you will like this in the future, tomorrow, the day after. So it's the future unknown value, very difficult to predict because of fashion, because of changes of culture, because of changes, a whole series of reasons. And in the culture industry, 9 out of 10 products fail. In the music industry, everybody says you make 10 records, 9 of them you lose money, but 1 you make all your money on that 1 record. Same with films. Hollywood make hundreds and hundreds of films, but it takes Avatar or Titanic, and you get all your money in. So it's a volatile, it's an unpredictable market. Fast moving, changes, very difficult to predict. So these cultural businesses develop very special business models to deal with this. And an English writer called it rationalizing the irrational. It was finding a way of rationalizing, having a rational business based on this unpredictable, irrational model. And of course, if you read a book, many books, they will tell you how the film industry has developed to deal with these questions. They have many ways of dealing with this. They can control cinemas. The Hollywood American film, I think American films in the last few years are terrible, the worst they've been for many, many years. But when I go to the cinema in Australia, when I go to the cinema in England, when I go to the cinema in China, it's all the same film, maybe 3-4 films. Everywhere in the world, in 1 week, it's maybe 10 films. Because the solution of Hollywood is, okay, let's buy the cinemas. Let's have the distribution deals. So it used to be like that with popular music. There used to be 5 or 4 major record companies. And if you had to go through them to get distribution deals. Of course, in the last 10 years, the digital revolution has destroyed that business model. Newspapers, the same thing. So each different sub-sector developed its own business model and different techniques of making money. And we need to, anybody who studies the cultural industries needs to understand that business model. Now, in the 1970s, when this kind of work was just being done, a lot of very important work done in the 70s and 80s, the cultural industries were seen as not very normal. A real industry was a car industry. It made big lumps of metal, it made hundreds of them, it employed thousands of workers on salary, etc. So the cultural industries were not quite normal. In fact, they were seen as sort of quite marginal businesses. They did involve mass reproduction. You made many, many records, you made many films, so there's mass reproduction. But that production was very labour intensive. You needed a lot of people to make things. You need a lot of creatives to make things. So it wasn't obvious that you could have productivity gains. The standard economic model would be, oh, well, we've got to make the labour process simpler, we've got to cut costs, we've got to maybe increase productivity to gain profit. This doesn't work in the cultural industries. It just doesn't work. So that for economists said, well, these are very strange businesses that, you know, they may be too artistic or too cultural to be real economic entities. And of course, they base themselves on independent contractors, creatives, who didn't often get a salary. So, some did. There were people employed in television stations, newspapers, but many, especially many of the more high-paid ones, weren't employed. They would work on a contract basis. So it's a very complicated labour market, very, very complicated. So many people saw it as, in fact, not as a real modern industry, but an older handicraft industry. We say handicraft, like a craft industry. You know, it's small scale, highly creative individuals making products. So it was seen as a craft industry, not really a modern industry. And so it was quite marginal. Governments weren't really interested in it. But the only bit they were interested in was the mass media. They were interested in television and a bit of film, because actually not because of money, but because of ideology. You know, it was part of the national identity. It was part of the power of the state in some ways. It certainly didn't make money.